The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. Thank you for being here today. We have an extensive agenda filled with facts and I don't know what else, but we've been waiting in anticipation to be able to listen to the state demographer, Tom Gillespie, and we look forward to learning about the workforce, the state workforce, teachers and public employees, and what the future looks like for early retirement, later retirements, and who we are going to be. Mr. Gillespie, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Gillespie. I'm the Minnesota State Demographer in the Minnesota Department of Administration, and thank you for inviting me here this morning. I was asked to present on some of the changes that we're expected to see, particularly in age structure of state and local workers, local government workers, as well as focusing specifically on some of the trends that might affect teachers, and I will attempt to look at all three groups. Minnesota's workforce is aging in general. Our state government workforce is also aging and is a bit older than the private sector workforce. Retirements from state and local government should soon begin to increase. Part of the decision making that people have is a short run, given the value of their IRAs and deferred compensation plans, things like that might affect the timing. But we are expecting to see substantial increases in the number of people retiring from state and local government over the next few years. And changing enrollments in schools will affect the demand for teachers. There are also significant issues regarding the supply of teachers. State government and local government in Minnesota, as well as the federal government, are older than the private sector. If we look at the population, the number of people who are currently employed in government over age 55, about 22% of Minnesota state government and about 23% of local government in Minnesota is over age 55, contrasted with about 14% of the private not-for-profit sector of the state, so that government is substantially older than the overall workforce. We are we're looking right now at a substantial proportion of workers in state and local government in their mid to late 40s and their 50s and moving into their late 50s and early 60s. This is a trend that we have been observing for some time, going back into the 1980s when we began to notice a continued and regular aging of the state government workforce, with each year leading to more people who are aging and relatively few young people entering entering state and local government workforce. In the executive branch, now this is data from 2003, in the state Minnesota state executive branch, full-time unlimited employees, about 61% in 2003 were over age 45. That is up from about 53% in 1997, merely 6 years before. So we continue to experience this aging process, and we are continuing to experience it today. Now, again, from 2003, the average age for retirement of state employees in Minnesota was age 60.2 years of age. that had been on a slight downward track that is slightly younger than the overall age for retirement, which is between age 62 and 63 in the United States, and sort of bounces up and down within that boundary, but is substantially lower than it was 2 to 3 decades ago. We have seen a decline in the average age of retirement. There is a possibility that we may, and some have argued that we may see an increase in the average age of retirement of all people in the workforce, in part being driven by the slower growth in the workforce, which may increase the demand, we believe, for older employees, the willingness of employers to retain people beyond the age of 60 or 62 or even 65. But also at the other end, that many people have simply not saved enough for retirement and may need to work longer. So we may see an increase in retirement age. Whether that affects state government workers is something that we will be watching closely, and we expect a transition to occur within the next 2 years, and we're watching very closely the trends in average retirement age of all workers. There are substantial differences within state government in the average age of retirement. People in the protective services, particularly Highway Patrol and corrections workers, retire at a much younger age, around age 55 to 56. But almost every group retires around age 62 or before. Similar to overall state and local government workers, Minnesota pre-K to 12 teachers are also experiencing some aging. The age structure is not quite as extreme as it is for state and local government workers, excluding teachers. But the age groups of 40 to 44 through 50 to 54 are still the largest age groups among teachers. The number of teachers currently employed who will turn age 62 in the very near-term future is expected to increase sharply. That also is true of the overall workforce and state government workers. We are 2008 is a major transition year for all workers in the United States and Minnesota, with the first wave turning age 62, and the number of people turning age 62 this year is in the overall workforce is about 30% larger than the number of turning age 62 last year. This same trend will be experienced among teachers, though slightly delayed by about a year. But 2009 should see about roughly a doubling in the number of teachers who will turn age 62. These are of teachers employed as of 2006. And within schools, there is a substantial difference in the proportion by occupation of older workers. It's not just teachers. We see a substantial proportion of school administrators who are over age 55. We see a substantial number of school librarians, janitors, cooks, school secretaries. It's almost across the entire occupation structure of K-12 education. We see a substantial number of people who are in their final years of working. One of the trends observed by the National Center for Education Statistics of the U.S. Department of Education, which does regular surveys of retirement intentions and retirement behavior of teachers nationwide, is a continued drop in the average age of retirement, a very slow drop. But the average age of retirement nationally in 2005 for teachers was 58.1 years of age, which is less than the overall age of retirement among all workers. The National Education Association is expecting a major turnover and major change in the number of teachers, and this sentiment is being reflected by almost everybody that does forecast. The Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development does forecast by occupation and by industry, and they are also expecting to see a major turnover in the number of teachers. Teachers in part are driven by the number of teachers is driven by the demand for teachers, and the demand for teachers to a large extent is being driven by the birth trends of the past. A child that was born today will be age 5 in 5 years, and will affect the demand for teachers in 5 years. The number of births in 2006, which is the most recent year that we have complete births for, the number of babies born in Minnesota in 2006 was the highest number since 1964. We have been on a modest upward trend. We expect that modest upward trend to continue towards the end of to the middle and end of next decade, and then level off after that. The young people who are high school seniors this year are the peak of the 80s, and this will be the largest graduating class that we will see for about a decade, is the children that are graduating this year. Right now we are seeing a decline in overall enrollments, but that decline in overall enrollments masks increases in secondary school enrollments and declines in primary school enrollments. That is about to reverse itself, and we will begin to see increases in primary school enrollments and declines in secondary school enrollments going forward into the future. Overall enrollments are projected to increase, but at a very slow pace, only about less than 0.6% per year over the next decade. But again, this masks substantial change within the school environment, where we expect to see a decline in the number of children in secondary schools, leveling off in the early part of next decade, essentially flat through the middle of next decade, and then beginning to pick up towards the end of next decade. While at the same time, we will be experiencing increases in primary school enrollments through the middle of next decade. As a result of the changes in the demand for teachers, driven by enrollment, we are expecting a modest increase in the number of teachers. About 0.4% per year over the next decade. That'll be substantially larger than the increases that we expect to see in state government, which are very, very small increases. Local government is projected to experience approximately 0.9% per year increase, which is slightly slower than all industries in Minnesota. But these overall growth rates that we expect to see in the overall number of jobs by type of job mask also the fact that there will be substantial numbers of people retiring and will need to be replaced. In elementary school education, we're expecting about a 32% increase in the 32% number of job openings over the next decade over current levels, but there will be approximately 2 replacement openings for every new opening in elementary school, so that we will need to find 2 teachers to replace retiring teachers for every new teacher that we will be looking for to deal with increasing enrollments. Similar is also true for middle schools. For secondary schools over the next decade, again, enrollments are expected to increase very, very slowly, but we are expecting to see a very large increase in the number of replacement openings, and as a result, we will continue to need substantial numbers of new teachers to simply fill positions that are being vacated by retiring teachers. This is true also of all occupations. Each occupation is a little bit different from the other, but this is an overall trend that we expect to see. So as a result, combining both the demand for new teachers because of due to enrollments, as well as the replacement for retiring and leaving and teachers leaving the profession, we're expecting to see a demand for about 7,900 new elementary school teachers, about 3,500 new middle school teachers, and about 7,100 new secondary school teachers. Most of that will be simply to replace retiring teachers. And with that, my presentation ends, and I will stand for any questions. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gillespie, we've been discussing a number of other concepts that kind of tie into some of the data you're talking about here. One of the issues that is not brought forward is a working assumption that I've had, that people generally are living longer and, as a result, also working longer. Is that some of the trends that you're seeing across the board in the state?
Madam Chair, Senator Bethel, we are seeing people living longer, and life expectancy continues to increase in the number of years that people expect to live past retirement has increased substantially. We have not seen that reflected in later retirement age. In fact, the trend has been towards ever earlier retirement age. One theory is, and one that we subscribe to, and in fact we've already included this in our forecast for workforce in the future, is that we will see an increase in retirement age and an increase in the likelihood of people in their mid to late 60s and of staying in the workforce. But we haven't really seen that yet to a large scale. We are watching that, and we will be receiving new data this coming week, in which we'll be looking at that trend again. The short-term market conditions may also be affecting delay of retirement and could cloud this picture for the next couple years, as people who balance potentially multiple sources of income, from defined benefit plans to annuities from deferred compensation plans. Those deferred compensation plans will likely be negatively impacted by current stock market and financial market situations. But as those clear up in the future, we would expect people to see people who have delayed retirement to continue to retire. My expectation is in the future that we will see people delaying retirement working longer, in part because of incentives from employers, but also in part because of need that has been reported by many surveys.
Madam Chair,
Senator.
Also, and I guess this would have been about your third slide when you pointed out that a higher percentage of government workers are over age 55 as compared to the private sector. Do you have any assumptions or any ideas why that would be? Is it because government employees just happen to stay working as government employees, and are these people in the private sector just not working anymore, or are they shifting to other professions, or why do we have the difference? Are you able to offer any ideas on that?
Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Senator Bethold, the trend that we have seen over the last couple decades has been for relatively slower growth in government, and when there are layoffs, the layoffs tend to be to the younger employees, and some areas of the private sector have grown at a substantially faster pace and have brought in many more younger employees. And it's that new infusion of younger people that has had a major impact.
So then, Madam Chair, what happens to the 55-year-old in the private sector? Do they just not work anymore? Do they? Where are they going?
Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Senator Bethel, there are, of course, people in their 50s and 60s in the private sector. Some employers in the private sector continue to encourage employees to take early retirement. That is not as widespread as it once was. And many employers now in the private sector are actually shifting gears and thinking about how to retain the older worker, particularly workers with unique skills and abilities that are difficult to replace. And that'll become an increasingly important issue, we believe, going forward into the future as the number of young people entering the workforce, both Minnesota and nationally, will begin to decline next decade, and the number of people leaving the workforce due to retirement is expected to increase. The demand for people with unique skills and abilities is going to increase, and there will be some effort to retain people in the workforce. This is a time of transition, and so we see several different models in operation right now. But that does tend to be the approach. Some surveys have also reported in terms of intentions of employees of people currently working, their intention to work longer. There seems to have been an increase over the last 10 years in the average age at which people expect to retire, which you would expect to, I would expect to see that having an actual impact on the retirement age, but to date it has not, since many people who retire do not do so necessarily in a planful or voluntary way, but due to other unexpected things such as illness or disability or other changes in their life or work situation that leads to their retirement.
Thank you.
Mr. Gillespie, on page 3 with the school employees box, you have several different occupations, but you don't have school bus drivers. Is this because they're a small group, or is this because they tend to come in, as we've been told before, after 45 and leave in 10 or 15 years? Or
Madam Chair, the school bus drivers would be very interesting here. That is a relatively smaller group, and many work on a part-time basis or other kind of contingency basis, and the data just really is not sufficiently robust to support much of a conclusion on school bus drivers in terms of this data set. However, I think if we looked at other data sets, we might be able to find some very interesting information on bus drivers.
And also, when we're doing, I've just been confronted in recent weeks, since school started, by various people that have talked about the situation in their schools. And it seems like the classes are getting bigger, and the teachers are having to deal with more things, with fewer materials and less backup support. So if those conditions were to continue over a long period of time, could we expect the people to work as long as projected, or will they want to get out?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, it's my understanding that work situation has a great deal to say about when people retire. and the degree to which they find work rewarding and satisfying when people do have options about retirement date, that does have a tendency to strongly affect those retirement dates. We also tend to think of retirement as an either or kind of proposition, but for many people it's a gradual removal or a partial removal from the workforce, and for many people there's a decision that is made as to whether or not to continue to work part time or in some other capacity rather than a full-time work, so that many people who retire, for example, at age 62 will still continue to be at least partially connected to the workforce for several more years. And so that adds complexity to this kind of issue, and clearly when people have options, they can act on those options, and their satisfaction for job becomes very important, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions from
Madam Chair?
The panel? Excuse me, just a minute, Representative Smith. If anybody in the audience has a question and wishes to pursue it, you can come down and sit at the end of the table. Okay, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I may have two or three questions.
Good.
Mr. Gillespie, there's a number of graphs here showing higher percentage of government workers over 55. Just there seems to be a number of graphs showing an increase in retired folks over the next two or three decades. Where's the numbers showing the growth, showing the increases or depicting the growth of the working population in Minnesota over those next two and three decades?
Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, do you mean the overall workforce or just the government workforce?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess what I'm getting at is the overall working part of the population compared to the non-working or retired part of the population over those next two and three decades in both numbers and percent.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, this is actually something that we've spoken and prepared materials extensively on. The overall workforce is aging, and in this, Minnesota is very similar to the rest of the country. The three big aspects of this, the three large aspects, I believe, are first that there are a substantial number of people in the United States workforce and the Minnesota workforce in their 40s and 50s today, and an increasing proportion in their early 60s, that a substantial number of these people will be moving towards retirement. The average age at which people receive their first Social Security check to date is between 62 and 63. They become eligible at 62, and they receive their first check within a year of that date. That's for the overall national workforce. The other aspect of that is that we will literally see fewer 18 to 24 year old age people available to enter the workforce over the next decade, both in Minnesota and nationally. And as a result, we are looking at a situation right now where not only will the workforce age at a substantial rate, because we'll have more people aging in place, fewer young people available to enter the workforce, but that the workforce nationally and in Minnesota will grow at a substantially slower pace than it has in the past.
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Gillespie, I want to return to that point, but I notice you have a graph showing Minnesota births from 1959 to 2035. I don't see any graphs showing an increase or depicting what the projected increase in Minnesota population is due to, for example, migration into the state from native-born Americans or migration into Minnesota from foreign-born. Where are those numbers?
Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that is not on this graph, but I can certainly provide those numbers. migration to a large extent, particularly interstate migration, is actually related to the workforce, to the labor market. And the stronger the labor market, labor force growth is, the stronger the job market is, the more people tend to move. For Minnesota, the history has been that if Minnesota has an average or below average job growth relative to the nation, we tend to have more people moving out of the state than moving in, and when we have an exceptionally strong job growth, we tend to have more people moving in than moving out. And as a result, we had a substantial migration of people into the state during the 90s when that job market was so tremendously strong. And that had also an impact on enrollments. Enrollments continue to increase because children tend to move with their parents. Immigration also tends to have some impact on this. And overall, migration this decade has been much slower than it was last decade, but there is still a slight in-migration to Minnesota, mostly from people moving here from other countries, and that does have some impact on overall enrollments. Where it has a much bigger impact is on enrollments of children in English learner language programs and special programs, in free and reduced lunch programs and other similar kinds of programs for recently immigrated or lower income families.
Madam Chair, one final question and then maybe a suggestion. Do you know right now, or can you supply me and us with this information? Right now and over the next 2 and 3 decades, right now, what of the entire population of Minnesota, what percent is retired and what percent is still in the workforce, whether it be governmental or private? What percent of the folks right now of this population of the state are working and are retired? Do you know?
Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I would not venture to pull a number off the top of my head because that's one I try not to memorize. But Minnesota does have one of the highest proportions of the population employed of any state in the country, and so we have a very high participation rate in the workforce. We do have information by age group and by gender, and that is forecasted, and we can provide that information on the number of people who are either working or looking for a job. In other words, that they are the projections there are of the workforce. The job number of jobs, of course, is also dependent on the economy, and that's a slightly different issue, but that's clearly related.
Madam Chair,
yes, sir, we can.
Representative Smith.
Just a thought, and that is this: at first glance, at first blush, perhaps looking at these graphs, one could draw this conclusion that, well, gee, a lot of folks are going to be retired in the next few years, and we're going to have a lot of demands for increased benefits, et cetera, and it's going to cost a lot of money, and where is it going to come from, and a little panic might set in. But I guess I would suggest, in order that we as a commission and as a legislature don't make decisions based on panic, I think we need to know in plain English whether the future working population, what the size of the future working population in this state is, and will it be able to sustain at our present expectations pensions down the road and demands on the public fisc. In other words, are enough folks going to be working in the next 2-3 decades to support increased growth on pension draw or not? And I think we need that information as we make our decisions.
Yeah. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, there's a couple things that are happening right now. One is that there is a commission on long-run budget trends that the Department of Finance is staffing, and and was related to a legislative requirement. Recent work that we've done with the state economist and staff in the Department of Finance have tried to look at long-run revenue trends as well as long-run expenditure trends in Minnesota, and working closely with the state economist, we've also looked at aspects of dependency ratios and things like that. I certainly would not expect would not suggest that this is a time to panic. That we are today just finishing a period in which we have a peak number of people in their peak earning years. This was something that we've been talking about for a couple decades now, that there's a very high proportion of people, particularly in Minnesota, but also nationally, who are in their peak earning years, but as they age, they will begin to retire, and they have not fully replaced themselves. In terms of numbers of people, that their children are not in sufficient number that they will replace themselves. So the dependency ratio, the proportion of older people to people of working age, will rise. It will not be at record levels, but it will rise. And it is something that prudent financial management would suggest that we be aware of and prepare for. But it is not, I don't believe, a time to panic. No, sir.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gillespie, I have two separate questions. The first is, I'm wondering whether in looking at our future workforce, we've factored in the fact that we now have, from what I've read in the newspapers, twice the cost as compared to the national average to receive a college education at a state institution in this state. I've also seen statistics that in various committees that would seem to indicate that when someone goes to college in a particular state, that makes it more likely that they're likely to continue living there. And so with the economy being what it is, if we've had a significant increase in the cost of college education in our state as compared to other states, are we considering that and factoring that in terms of keeping our future workforce? So that's one question I have. And then my second question has to do with the last comment you just made about not the disparity between people retiring and people in the workforce not being at record levels. I wonder, everything I've heard over the last couple of years is that over the next 20 to 30 years, we're going to have, instead of three people in the workforce as we do today for every one person retired, we're only going to have two people in the workforce for every one person who's retired. And the information I've received is that, since the history of our country, we are expanding the change in that ratio. So I'm wondering, at what time in the past have we had a greater proportion of people retired in comparison to people in the workforce as compared to what we can expect to see in the next 20 to 30 years? Or did I misunderstand your comment?
Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, let me address the second one first. What I referred to before was the dependency ratio, which looks at both older people and younger people in the population relative to the number of people of working age. That will not be at record levels, but we are aging as a society, and this is a very unique situation. This has never really happened before, not just in Minnesota or nationally, but even internationally, that Europe is much older than we are, Japan is much older than we are, and much of the world's population is moving towards an aging environment. We are sort of in the middle of that group of countries that are aging right now. The concept of retirement is a relatively recent concept. As far back as my grandparents, there just simply was not a concept of retirement. that you continued working until you couldn't work anymore, and you survived as best you could. It was really in the 1930s that we began to move to programs such as Social Security and other kinds of programs, and regular retirement planning didn't really begin even until the 1950s, and so this is a relatively new concept that in the history of the nation. So it's difficult, I believe, to compare, for example, the 1920s or 1930s with today's situation, but we do have a substantially low dependency ratio right now. We are at record low levels of dependent population and very high proportions of working age people and of working people in our society. So basically right now we really truly do have a peak number of people in their peak earning years, which we will never see again. The question is, have we prepared for the future sufficiently to prepare a situation for them to continue on this track towards retirement and continue down the path that we've been on for a few decades? And that gets back to your question about education. One of the things that the Federal Reserve Bank, all the economists I know, and many others that have looked at the situation point to education as being really the wellspring of Minnesota's prosperity, that we have produced a very high quality workforce, and the question then becomes one of, will we have that kind of workforce in the future sufficient to meet this new challenge of increasing numbers of dependent population, and will we have enough bright young people to fuel the economy to meet those kinds of demands? And I don't know of anybody that has a real good answer for that. There are concerns that have been raised.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Gillespie. I appreciate your answer, but what I'm wondering very specifically with respect to this information you've given us is, has anyone considered the increased tuition expenses in Minnesota relative to other states and factored that in terms of what we can expect as far as our workforce numbers? I mean, either we are planning for that, because statistically I think that would be a pretty big consideration to leave out, or maybe we're going to plan to correct that so that our tuition falls back more in line, cost falls back more in line with other states. Do we have a policy approach toward that, or are we giving it some consideration?
Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we have looked at educational attainment and continue to monitor that, but we have not looked at the relationship between cost and educational attainment, no, and not that I'm aware of. There may have been some work in the Office of Higher Education. I'm not sure. And on that, I would have to defer to greater expertise.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Gillespie, what was that commission that you were talking about, Commission on Long-Run Budget?
Madam Chair, it's the Budget Trends Commission in the Department of Finance, and there is a web link, and I can certainly supply that to staff.
Thank you. And then if you would confer with Representative Smith, do you have a specific request for further information?
Well, Madam Chair,
those two questions.
Madam Chair, I don't think so. I guess what I was trying to get at was a fundamental question that we're talking about, and that is, will the next two or three decades, will we have enough of folks who are working be able to sustain at the current level the pensions that are paid and also the expected increases that we will be addressing?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative
Mr.
Smith,
Gillespie.
And I'll provide information, more specific information, but as a general thought, which also connects with the question that Senator Olson had on education, is that the future economic growth depends really on two things. It depends on the number of workers, which is what I'll be able to provide you information on. It also depends on the productivity of those workers and what happens to that. And the productivity of the workers depends in part on private investment. It depends in part on technology. It depends in part on our ability to prepare infrastructure, to prepare the environment for a strong economy. But it also depends on the ability, the background and education of the workers in Minnesota to absorb the new technologies and learn new things and achieve the highest level of productivity possible. And so that, in part, is a highly related question, but I will provide information that we have on the number of workers as well.
And, Mr. Gillespie, do you have any information on how health care affects retirement, health care insurance, and costs of health care affecting retirement?
Madam Chair, there is some information that the Department of Health has pulled together on the average cost by age group of health care in the United States, and there is a huge jump from the age group of 45 to 54 to the 55 to 64-year-old age group. And it's that 55 to 64-year-old age group that will be the most rapidly growing and also the one that's moving towards retirement. Healthcare cost there is roughly double the cost in the previous age group and then continues to rise sharply afterwards. The expectation is that because of aging of our society, that healthcare costs will rise at a much faster pace than we've experienced in the past. And, it appears right now that healthcare is really going to be a major factor in government budgets going forward into the future. That the Budget Trends Commission has also been exploring that issue.
Thank you. Are there any other comment? Is there anyone that wishes to make a comment or any further questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your information, your willingness to come.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is the fiscal people from House staff, Senate staff, on K-12 funding and how to try to give us an understanding of how pensions or the retirement costs are factored into the financing of K-12 as we go forth or as we've done in the past. And does the money for retirement and pensions compete with the money for the students in classrooms? Or is this money just the first thing that's put in the bank? Mr. Crow?
Madam Chair, my name is Mr. Greg.
Mr. Marks, Crow. Welcome.
I am the fiscal analyst for education finance in the House. We've got a little brief background information we'll give you on how school finance works and how it interplays with pension costs that districts have, and then we'll have time for any questions that you might have, or you can interrupt with questions if you want to. Basically, the legislature determines the
amount
of...
Excuse me, Mr. Crow. Are you going to be joined by Mr. Nauman, or...?
He is...
Madam Chair, we believe he's in transit.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Is there another chair for him then when he comes so he can slip in and we won't even notice? Thank you so much. Go ahead, Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, As I'm sure you know, the legislature determines the amount of state aid that school districts get, the appropriations that you make each year, determine the total amount of funding they get. And in addition, the state also sets limits on what they can levy for local property taxes to fund schools. So there are two basic sources of funding for schools. About 80% of their funds they get are from the state. In the form of state aid, about 20% of the funds they get are locally raised levies, and some of those are voter approved levies. Some of those are district school board approved levies that are limited by state statute. Most of the funding that they get is allocated on a per pupil basis. We calculate the number of pupils they have using some formulas that create weightings for different grades that the students are in, and then we allocate out money to each district based on the number of pupils that they have and the characteristics of those pupils. Most of you know the basic education funding formula, which is about a little more than $5,000 per pupil. That's the biggest source of revenue for school districts, and that's a good example of per pupil funding.
And Madam Chair, members, some of the funding is what we refer to as categorical funding. And unlike the undesignated general funding, categorical funding is based on a specific formula and often for a specific purpose. And some of this funding is not a student-based formula. As Mr. Crowe said, much of our funding is student-based. That is, we simply count the number of pupils and provide a formula allowance based on that number of pupils. These categorical programs include things like special education, where the funding is a reimbursement based on the school district's actual spending on special education services. So in the special education area, for example, we don't count the number of special ed pupils. We don't provide a formula allowance for that. Instead, we count expenditures, and we provide a reimbursement for a portion of those expenditures. This type of formula, this categorical formula, is the type that we used to have when we dealt with teacher retirement costs. The employer share of teacher retirement costs was formerly a categorical program. You've got a green sheet in front of you, a couple of pages, and the first couple paragraphs of that address this issue. Prior to the mid-1980s, the state paid the full amount of the teacher retirement costs directly to the teacher retirement funds. So in other words, the school district, even though they were in the employer, they weren't making the payment to the retirement fund. Instead, the state was making that payment directly to the retirement association for those teachers. There were a number of questions raised about this method of funding. There were several studies that were undertaken in the early and mid-1980s. And for 2 years, a formula was put in place that essentially created an aid formula. The money started going to districts for teacher retirement based on this formula, and then the districts would pay that money to the retirement systems. 2 years after that was implemented, legislation passed during 1987. That legislation made some big changes to our school funding formulas. We changed our terminology. We went from a program called the Foundation Program to the General Education Program, and Senator Randy Peterson was instrumental in these changes coming about. The result of this was to eliminate a number of categorical funds, and one of those was the categorical funding for retirement costs. So this change, implemented by the 1987 legislature, effective for 1989, meant that instead of the state paying for teacher retirement on a cost basis, school districts simply got a larger per pupil amount of money, and then it was their obligation to pay the amount necessary into the teacher retirement fund. So essentially what happened is we went from a system prior to 1985 where we had a categorical program where the full amount of the retirement was paid into the fund by the state to 2 years of a formula, and then after that, for the last 20 years now, school districts simply have a larger general education per pupil funding amount, and it's their obligation to pay into the retirement system based on the retirement system formulas.
Mr. Strom, prior to 1987, then was that from 1972 to 1987, or was that from 1858?
Madam Chair, that's a question I don't know the answer to. I know from 72 forward it was. I don't know the history prior to that. I suspect some of your pension staff probably could tell you that, or we'd be happy to get back to you on that.
Just Just wondering. Mr. Martin.
Madam Chair, you're going to have to rely on my memory since I wasn't necessarily certain that this was going to come up, but the state participation generally in teacher funding really goes back to 1967 and the sales tax. Before 67, with TRA, there were allocations to TRA, but they were fairly modest numbers of dollars. It was done directly to TRA, and it was done to the extent that the payout of our retirement annuities from TRA in any given year was greater than the money that was available that had been saved for the retired teacher. And so TRA was created in 1915, and the number of our retirements before the 60s was not very great. In 67, there was the sales tax. Part of the sales tax was used to pay for teacher retirement. There was then the direct payments to TRA increased, and the three first-class city teacher plans also received portions of the new money that was created by the advent of the sales tax. There was some jiggering of the dollar amounts in the first couple of years to accommodate differences in payrolls and in teacher pension cost. So the first year or two of the aid and after the 67 sales tax was probably smaller to the first class city teachers than it should have been and was self-corrected or was corrected over the next session or two.
Thank you. Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Crow.
As Mr. Strom indicated, the pension funding has kind of gone from designated to undesignated, and that's generally how school district payments have gone. Most of the money that they currently receive is undesignated money that can be spent by the school board however they wish, and there are some state and federal laws that restrict how they can spend that money in some cases. For example, the requirements for special ed, requirements the teachers are licensed, the PELRA law, and the obligations to pay into TRA and PERA. And then obviously they bargain with their employees to allocate some of their funding. Basically, school boards set salary rates of teachers through PELRA, and the rates and number of employees hired by the district determine the district's retirement obligations.
And Madam Chair, the point
we're trying
to make for you today is that school funding essentially now is a per pupil based funding with obligations that are sometimes specified separately from the funding that's provided. As a couple of examples, we have a very small amount of funding that's a designated funding for a program such as Gifted and Talented. We pay school districts about $12 per pupil for that program. Most districts spend quite a bit more than that on Gifted and Talented programming. They simply take that money from their undesignated general fund to do that. In addition, the legislature sometimes specifies other requirements on districts without providing any funding. For example, with the curriculum and testing decisions, testing requirements that have gone into place over the last 5 years, very few of those changes have been accompanied by specifically earmarked money for those purposes. So in other words, the state legislature is determining a revenue amount for school districts on the one hand. On the other hand, is essentially telling districts, you spend that money how you best see fit. And I suppose using their toes, since they've used both hands. And on the other hand, the legislature is also saying, and here are some obligations, some additional obligations that we want to put on you. And whether those obligations are things like curricular matters or changes to the bargaining system, changes to the system regarding how school buses are operated and who could drive those, or changes regarding a retirement system, they're essentially the same type of factor. The legislature may be imposing costs on the one hand. On the other hand, it's provided a block grant, a fixed amount of revenue per pupil as the funding level. Most of the pension changes that have come through the legislative
process. Those changes regarding both the reimbursements and the criteria have come outside of the K-12 committees of the legislature, not surprisingly, of course. This commission, as you're aware, has usually been the starting place for things like determining the contribution rates, the benefit levels, rule of 90, and other such things have generally emerged outside of the discussions of funding, where the overall level of K funding should be set, and the separate discussions that, at least on the House side, go into determining how much the formula allowance should increase each year. There have been some changes to how the school funding is constructed that have been wrapped around the changes in the retirement rates. Those changes, again, have had an interesting history. Often they've been we've had about three or four different times when we've made a specific change to school funding based on a change in the employer contribution rate. Those changes, again, have usually been initiated outside of the normal budgeting process. Next, I'd mention that there have been some cases where there have been some supplementary aid payments made and ongoing payments made to pension funds. Again, those generally are discussed outside of the context of the K-12 Education Committee.
As we mentioned, the funding that districts get is primarily undesignated, and oftentimes in the legislature, the changes that are made to pension contributions are made outside of the school finance discussions that are happening in the K-12 committee. So in some cases, districts are able to help their general fund balances if they don't get additional state aid and they do have additional costs imposed on them by raising local levies. But for the most part, levies that they can raise that are undesignated are the voter-approved operating levies, and so those are conditional on voters okaying those levies. The other levies that they can raise are specifically designated for types of expenditures. For example, they can do unemployment insurance levy that is limited by their unemployment costs that has to be spent on unemployment costs. They can do a health and safety levy, but it's for specific health and safety costs, and the expenditures have to be made on health and safety expenditures. So they're limited in their ability to raise money on their own to adjust for additional costs imposed on them by the legislature.
And, Madam Chair, I'd add on that an example of one of these kinds of levies was just passed this last year, which is the levy for other post-employment benefits. That levy was a part of the first tax bill that passed in the 2008 session and was an example where the legislature gave specific authority to school districts, as well as other units of local government, but to school districts to issue state bonds for some of their retiree health benefit liabilities. And essentially created a funding mechanism for school districts to pay for those. That levy authority was granted to the school districts without voter approval. So a number of school districts this fall will be using that levy to essentially selling bonds and using the levy to repay those bonds in order to fund these other post-employment benefit liabilities. And I would add that that's a model that there are a variety of reasons why if that had come out of the education world may have looked differently than if it come out of the tax world, but that's a model this committee may want to think about some if there are going to be changes to the retirement system that might impose a cost on the school districts. This was not in response to a specific legislative action, but rather was a response to past behavior of school districts. And the tax bill essentially authorized these bonds to be sold.
Finally, in the big picture, Madam Chair, school districts have designated and undesignated funding. Changes that are made to increase their costs, such as contribution rate increases for pension costs, if they're not accompanied by an additional state aid payment or some other way for districts to generate revenue to pay for those costs, the cost of those higher contribution rates, for example, has to come out of their undesignated general fund balance, which is generally what they use to pay for the overall cost of educating kids in those school districts. So if there isn't a mechanism to fund those costs, whether it's state aid or the authorization of a local levy, that funding will come out of the funding that they use generally for educating kids.
So Is there any oversight that, or is anyone checking to see that they put in the amount of money that they have to put in?
Madam Chair, members, yes, the Retirement Association certainly would notify the Department of Education and the school district if they didn't receive the payments from the districts for their obligation. This issue comes up more often with charter schools than with school districts. As you know, we have almost 150 charter schools now, and we've had some instances in where the charter school finances have not gone well, where the charter schools have needed to close. And there's been a few cases there where the teacher retirement associations have notified the Department of Education that they are not getting their payments from the charter schools. But with school districts, I'm not aware of a circumstance where those payments haven't been made.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just noted that Mr. Nauman has joined us, and I'd just like to extend an invitation for him to join us.
Mr. Nauman, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure I have anything additional to add.
Oh.
You did a very admirable job in my absence.
Well, at least in case there is, you can jump right in now without us having to wait. These bonds that you said, of course, we remember that we passed it, and they're just that we're allowing school districts to bond now. Do we have a limit on the how many bonds they can issue, or how many years this bonding can take place in?
Madam Chair, essentially the legislation that passed last year requires the school district to identify the amount of its liability that it has for these retiree health benefits. Once it does that, then it often will work with a financial partner to determine how it wants to structure the bonds. There are a couple of caps that those bonds fall under. There's an overall limit on the number of bonds that school districts can issue, and there are also time periods on those bonds. And I suspect that the other post-employment benefit bonds are limited to a 20-year time period. Now, a school district could issue a series of those. For example, a district with a large problem may issue some bonds this fall for that, start paying those off over a 20-year schedule in 3 or 4 years, determine that they need to issue some more bonds for that issue. And there may be some reasons why school districts don't want to both levy for the bond costs and issue bonds for the full amount of that liability.
Right. And it's for health benefits rather than strictly retirement benefits, or am I wrong?
Madam Chair, the majority of the other post-employment benefits that school districts have, the vast majority of that is a retiree health benefit, yes.
And when we passed this, did we say it was just for a short time, or
no,
or
Madam
that
Chair,
they
that,
could
that
do
authority
this?
Is ongoing.
Okay, and we're not going to pull it out from under them.
Madam Chair, that's something that you'll all decide.
I did hear someone say at a local meeting that we're going to do it right now, so that when they decide 2 years from now that we can't do it anymore, we're going to have that our first round in anyway. Why would they have that doubt?
Well, Madam Chair, one of the issues with school finance, as Mr. Crowe mentioned, was that the state legislature sets both the aid amounts and a levy share. Essentially, school district levies are a creature of state policy. There are some exceptions to that. The levy authority that allows voter approval for additional money is an example of something outside of that. But generally speaking, the legislature controls school district levies. And as a result, when something like the authority to levy for bonds for the other post-employment benefits is passed, there's a levy impact associated with that. There's a great deal of uncertainty about how big a levy impact that's going to be. The guess, I believe, at the time that was passed was somewhere maybe in the $10 million range. Some of the school districts that had very large retiree liabilities are likely to issue very large amounts of bonds, and there's some concern that that could be a very big number. And as Mr. Crow was saying, money levy authority aid for school districts is all essentially, from a budget perspective, kind of fungible. If the legislature were to choose, instead of giving school districts $20 million a year of authority for this purpose, they could give them $20 million of a levy authority for a different purpose, full-day kindergarten, smaller class size, something along those lines. So I think the concern is that because the legislature, as one of its ways of controlling education spending, uses those levies, is that there's a possibility that that levy authority could be used for a different purpose. Not that specific authority, but, I mean, the general, you know, that $20 million that's spent on OPEB bonds could be spent on full-day kindergarten instead. So I think that's the nature of the discussion and why there's some concern about how long that authority for school districts will last.
And these are separate bonds from their building bonds and from their any other kind of bonds that they can have. These are additional bonds.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The department has come up with a very nice way of classifying these bonds, so they're going to be easily identifiable and separate, because school districts use a fund series of accounting, and bonds should all be in the same fund. But the department's done a good job of making sure that these can be identified and kept separate from those that are issued for building projects.
Thank you. Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow, Mr. Nauman, now tell me about how the school districts pay for the pensions and the retirement of school bus drivers and cooks and janitors.
Same thing? Madam Chair, very much the same thing, with the difference being, of course, that most of those employees are going to be in PERA, not in TRA. With the bus drivers, many of the school districts contract for bus services, so for the bus drivers that are not employees, their retirement would be with their private employer and not with the state.
Many school districts, and it's growing, correct? But there are some that have...
Madam Chair, I think the numbers have held relatively constant over time. There tend to be a little bit cyclical. I know a couple of the larger metro districts in the last few years have switched back from contracting for bus services to running those operations in-house. I believe both the Bloomington and the Hopkins School District in the last couple of years have switched back to hiring employees and operating their own bus fleet as opposed to contracting.
Sam Betzel.
So thank you, Madam Chair. Of course, the pension bill that we passed this past year did require us to make some recommendations to the next legislature on at least teacher retirement, and which is one of the reasons why we wanted your insights here. As I recall, the fiscal note that was prepared this last year to just have teacher retirement lowered to the age of 62, I believe had a price tag of about $60 million a year, as I recall. And from what I'm hearing you saying, I'm assuming that very few school districts are going to have built into their budgets right now any way to absorb any part of that cost. I'm assuming we're going to have a difficult time increasing the contribution from the employees to get there. To do anything to lower the retirement age for teachers is probably going to require some either state funds infusion there, which are going to be used for the employer and the employee, or from levy authority. Or are those the options that we're going to be looking at as we delve into that issue?
Mr. Nauman?
Well, Madam Chairman, Senator Betzel, there's Mr. Crow identified before that the dollars are fungible, so a third option would be for simply to take it out of the classroom.
Right.
Not adding any money and changing the contribution, you would be effectively reducing the amount of resources that districts have to spend on other things.
Yeah. And, Madam Chair, I'd add one other thought to that. The next year's legislature, of course, will be a budget year, and they'll be setting the relative amount of the school formula. Maybe they'll be proposing to increase that 2% or 4%. Each percent on the formula costs roughly $50 million. So another option that people could think about is if the formula allowance increase would otherwise have been 3%, if that's 2% and the 1% is a retirement, that's sort of the trade-off you'd be thinking about. And And so, as Mr. Nauman said, it is clearly a case that, you know, as we said at the beginning, there's a series of expenditures that school districts face, and there's a revenue source that's set separately from that. Sometimes those are linked. So that's something for people to think about as well.
Mm-hmm. And so, Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow, Mr. Nauman, these people that are going around the state, the education leaders that are going around the state talking about a new formula package and new package of funding schools, are the numbers that they're using considering pension costs in addition to the costs of educating the children?
Madam Chair, members, those hearings have been talking about a bill that roughly has a state aid cost of about $2 billion per year more than what we're currently funding. And the mechanism is similar to what we've got now, which is essentially saying, here's your revenue side of it, figure out how you're going to spend that. So I guess I'd say that they're not considering a link to there, but on the relative magnitude of things, and again, I'm not, you know, there's been talk about phasing that bill in and that kind of thing, but if you're talking about an increase of that size, if you're talking about, you know, an increased pension cost for the districts of that amount, that would be very, you know, would be a relatively small amount of that total increase. But I think it's important to reiterate that that's a very large increase that bill is talking about.
Mm-hmm. And when you're talking to legislators, individual legislators that come to you with these wonderful out-of-the-box solutions for educating our kids, do you always mention that, of course, there's increased costs for retirements and pensions?
Madam Chair, usually the pension costs are relatively a low-level issue with school districts compared to some of their other growing costs, such as the cost for special education and health benefits. Those tend to be the ones we hear much more from school districts about.
So school districts aren't making a fuss?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if school districts are expecting that the next legislature is going to increase their employer contribution rates for teacher retirement. So I would say in general, though, the pension changes rate lower than some other changes. For example, a few years ago when this committee recommended the changes to the Minneapolis teacher retirement and the changes that were affected with that, there was relatively little that I heard from the school districts about that. So in terms of magnitude of other changes, I think that was relatively small for them.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just kind of following up on your question, Madam Chair, we all know realistically that going into the next session, we're likely to be facing a substantial deficit. And it sounds like from what I'm hearing, and maybe I'm overlooking another option, but it sounds like from what I'm hearing, the teachers are asking us to increase pension benefits as well as other aid to the class, or aid on the per pupil allowance or aid to education. And our options for funding that then appear to be, when you say additional levy authority, I assume we're talking about a property tax increase then, or additional revenue to the state. Obviously, we'd have, I mean, those are our only other choices. We have a property tax increase. We have income tax increase or some other way to get additional revenue to the state, or we take it out of the classroom, or we take it away from another part of our budget. And considering how much money we're talking about, I guess that means a substantial cut, say, in nursing home spending or something like that. Are the teachers, in addition to asking for this additional revenue, are they suggesting a preference or a willingness to say where this additional revenue or what they would like to see the legislature do in terms of additional revenue, assuming they don't want it coming out of the classroom?
Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think that's a question you may want to direct directly to the teachers. I don't, in my experience advocates on behalf of an additional benefit generally don't come in and say, here's the place I'd like you to cut it. It mm-hmm. tends to draw the battle lines. I think they're probably looking for you to come up with a suggestion on that point. But as we were talking in response to Senator Betzold's question, I think those are the basic three options that you have. You could take it out of the classroom, you could do the levies, or you can pay for it on a state aid basis.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, well, I'm fully aware that, you know, that's why we get paid so much, so that we can make those really tough decisions about, you know, about where the funding is going to come from, and that it's ultimately our decision. But I think the point I'm trying to make is that we all realize that, you know, we don't mint money. It has to come from somewhere. And it really helps to hear what people's tolerance is in terms of what they're willing to do to have us consider. I mean, knowing the realities of the situation that we face in the state, taking a position they're willing to support, both in terms of the revenue needs they have as well as the resource and where it's going to come from, I think would be helpful.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, full information always makes the decisions easier. That's true. I think in terms of the Senate process, you'll recall that we do have a target allocation process where we figure out how much we either have to cut or raise to balance the books, and that process would be something that would be a consideration as we move forward. It wouldn't necessarily come out of nursing homes. It could be a revenue raiser, or it could be cuts out of a different area of the budget. Some of that's implicit in the discussion, or we could make the target allocation made to the K-12 committee that includes a benefit change such as the one you're contemplating could actually be assumed in a lower target, or such as what Mr. Strom was describing, instead of a 3% increase on the formula, instead of doing just a 2% increase on the formula, we do a 3%, and then we're assuming some amount that would go to the pay for the pension benefits. So it's hard to isolate exactly what your choice is, but I think it would be helpful to have the teachers talk to you about that point.
And I'm sure they will.
I'm sure they will.
Any other questions? Anyone in the audience have a question? Well, thanks so much, Mr. Nauman, Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom. Come again. Thanks for the information, too. The August 21st minutes are in our packet, and they have been distributed.
I'll move them, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzold moves adoption as printed. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The adoption is made. Senator Betzold. Next item on the agenda, the commission's principles of pension policy, and we're doing principle 2C8, post-retirement benefit adequacy. Mr. Martin, refresh my mind.
Members, if you have your July 18th memo, this would be the middle part of page 20 as the start of the discussion of post-retirement benefit adequacy. The Commission's principles divide adequacy into two parts: adequacy at retirement, which we dealt with the last time the Commission looked at this document, and post-retirement benefit adequacy, the theory being, I presume, that it's simpler if a benefit is adequate at retirement to then conclude that you need to maintain the adequacy. If the benefit is not adequate at our retirement, our retirement benefits then add a degree of complexity in that you're trying to catch up for something that you didn't do with the initial plan design. So This is presuming, the commission's principle is assuming that there is an inadequate benefit at retirement and that we're attempting to maintain adequacy during our retirement. And the current principle, which is set forth in the middle of page 20, suggests that inflation is what erodes post-retirement benefit adequacy, and we need to replace that impact of inflation over time. That, consistent with the longstanding part of the principle, goes back to the 60s, that post-retirement increases should be funded on an actuarial basis, and then also suggests that an unspecified, valid, recognized economic indicator of inflation be used as the basis for the post-retirement adjustment mechanism. So that's the current principle. The legislation that is a variant mostly relates to the post fund, and both in 97 and then most recently in 2008, so items 1 and 8. The addition of a consumer price index component that occurred back in the early 90s was modified in 1997. Before 1997, the post fund was set up to replace the impact of inflation up to 3.5% per year, and that was downsized to 2.5% per year. This was part of a somewhat complicated trading around of actuarial cost impact items. The savings in a lower limit on the post fund, the actuarial savings was part of the funding for a benefit improvement at the time of retirement that also was enacted in 97. Most recently, in 2008, the legislation that provides for a potential dissolution of the post fund was adopted. And if the dissolution would occur, the revised post-retirement mechanism for the statewide plans would not utilize an inflation indexing tool, but would simply have an automatic 2.5% percentage increase annually, irrespective of whatever the consumer price index increase might be. So a departure or at least diminution of the previous utilization of a economic indicator to drive post-retirement increases. The other changes that are specified have to do with the local plans. The creation of some additional 13th checks in the case of Fairmont, and then pointing on number 7, the demonstration project of the St. Paul Teachers Plan, which was a replacement of the prior investment gain-based post-retirement adjustment mechanism with a post-retirement adjustment mechanism based on wholly on the consumer price index with a 5% maximum on the annual amount of the increase. So in light of that, we've tried to fashion for you a change in a potential change in the policy principles. These appear on pages 22 and 23. The bottom of 22 and the very top of 23 is one approach followed towards the middle of 23 with an alternative. The first version that we suggest is to have the post-retirement increases be periodic rather than referencing adequacy, that the increases should function to share advantageous investment performance, that being the old post fund and some of the 13th checks that have been added over time, retaining the actuarial basis for funding post-retirement increases, and again, replicating the investment performance basis for a retirement mechanism that underlies the current post fund and some of the 13th checks. The alternative attempts to key more specifically on the 2008 change in the post fund, where there's a disconnection of post-retirement adjustments from the inflation index if the dissolution triggering event should occur and the post fund be sufficiently underfunded. And here, it would reduce the principal to periodic increases, and that the post-retirement increases should be funded on an actuarial basis, and drops any specificity of on what basis the post-retirement increases should occur. So we've provided, since the post-retirement adjustment mechanisms that we've used over time have never, with the exception of the demonstration project for the St. Paul teachers, never wholly been based on an inflation index. If the commission wants to modify its principles to either reflect what we've been doing historically, which is largely utilizing investment gains to pay post-retirement increases, there is language that follows that theory. If the most recent legislative activity, the 2008 change in the post fund, reflects the commission's thoughts, we're moving towards a system where there are periodic increases, but it's not necessarily connected in any direct way to inflation, and is also not connected in any direct way to investment performance. Then a simplification of the policy principle to just look at it, the periodic nature of increases and the actuarial funding of the increases may be a better way to state the principles. With that,
yeah.
Happy to try and answer questions.
Periodic meaning yearly?
Representative, currently we do this, generally among our pension funds, we do annual increases, but not always. There are instances with the current post fund when investment performance is insufficient, at least before the introduction of the consumer price index portion of the current post fund formula. There were times when there were no increases paid because there was no investment gain. That occurs also in the 13th check plans, where there's no investment gain, there's no post-retirement increase paid. So periodic means that it can happen on occasion, perhaps regularly and annually, but not specifying that. To the extent that we're trying to reflect what you folks have currently done as a reflection of what you think the best policy is, periodic seem to be the best way to describe something that happens on occasion but does not specify any regularity in any specific way.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, in the past you've had the major stakeholders join us, if that's
And I was just going to, I was going to do that.
Okay. My thoughts, Madam Chair, is I think probably the word adequacy probably does need to be changed, because then we're going to be getting into debates whether or not particular retirement benefits are adequate or not, and then we're going to get into the cost of living increases, inflation, and so forth. And I think that that, you know, has led to some problems in the past. We wound up in the 90s, when the stock markets were doing well, awarding benefit increases simply because the funds were doing well. And I think that I think we've recognized that that's probably not a good policy, because if you're going to award benefit increases when the times are good, what are you going to do when the times are not so good as they are right now? And I think that that's probably not how we should be considering increases, but rather that people ought to be having increases in good times and in bad times, but they ought to even out. And so I think that to the extent that the first proposal talks about sharing advantageous investment performances, again, leads us into the problem of just giving out increases because we're doing well, and it doesn't answer the question, what do we do when we're not doing well? I think the second proposal, in the middle of page 23, I think is a better approach. I mean, we're always going to be talking about increases. I think we're never going to talk about decreasing the pensions. But if we do increase it, I think it should be have some actuarial basis for doing so, and beyond the fact that the stock market is doing well, or inflation is going up, or the cost of living is going up. I mean, it has to be meet some actuarial test to do that. So at least between the two proposals, I think the second alternative is better than the first, but that's, you know, based upon what I've seen and heard here.
Anyone else want to offer input? Mr. Kapler?
I'm a little unclear what the term on an actuarial basis means. I always have been, frankly, in the principles here, that's the actuaries are going to project the cost of the increases in future dates for retirees and build that into normal cost. I mean, that's what we're doing now in St. Paul, except for the fact that we've got this kind of crazy investment-related trigger on the CPI-derived increases. But if we're going to give increases based on cost of living measures, and we have to make some assumption about what we think that increase is going to cost us and what we think is going to happen to inflation in the future. That just gets built into normal costs, and it becomes a part of the liabilities for each retired life. And the actuaries can estimate that. And then the issue is have we bet right on inflation, future inflation? And that's what's meant by that.
It makes sense to me.
Mr. Martin?
What Mr. Kapler may not be focusing on is the historic nature of this document. Once upon a time, post-retirement increases were granted on an ad hoc basis and frequently were not provided. No additional funding was provided. An increase that is part of an automatic mechanism will be measured by the actuary. So there will be actuarial measurement, and that's what you were mostly speaking to. And that's simply a function of if it's automatic, if it's a promised benefit, the actuary then has to take it into account in the actuarial work. Whether the funding for it is actually provided or not is another matter. So by talking about funded on an actuarial method, I think the policy principle is looking to both measurement and to having the source of the funding be done in a manner that leaves the pension plan actuarially solvent.
That makes sense to me, Madam Chair.
Jay?
Madam Chair and Commission members, I would make some comments about cautioning moving forward with, on page 23 at the very top, the changes in B and D on the top section of the page. Those two relates specifically to sharing investment gains. And I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, there was a federal federal change or some changes in the, at the federal level. I think it was the Economic Growth and Tax Reform Act, which included a lot of pension changes, a lot of change in pension regulation at both the corporate and the public level. Most of the changes were geared towards some of the excesses, I guess I would say, that were taking place in the corporate plans, but the changes then were also applied to the public plans. And what the federal laws now indicate is that any investment gain sharing is prohibited in cost of living arrangements on both the corporate and the public side. Any current arrangements have been grandfathered in. So it seems to me that B and D on the top of page 23 are actually bringing more of that into our state policies rather than really staying away from it as the current move at the federal level. So I guess I would caution and maybe, you know, have staff do some research on that before you approve today anything related to B and D and on the top part of that page.
So B and D at the very top of page 23.
Correct.
You are questioning. Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, as Senator Betzold indicated, I think I'm more comfortable with lines 14 to 23. In agreement with Mr. Stoffel about the concerns on BND. But the policy is indicated on lines 14 to 23, I think I'm comfortable with, and I can't speak for anyone else. But.
And I see two people shaking their heads in agreement.
Got it.
What about the both of them, we've crossed out the word adequacy and just addressed increases. Is that acceptable? Any other comments? Oh, Representative Thiessen?
Madam Chair, and I apologize because I have not been through many of these.
I
so
know.
What's the process?
We're so happy
actually,
to have you here
I'm
today.
I'm really thrilled to be here.
We can have a motion.
Is that what we do to? Have we been?
Madam Chair, I'll move the 2C8B amended with lines 14 to 23 on page 23.
Betzold motion is before us, Representative Thiessen.
Well, I guess then I would like to speak because I'm not totally comfortable taking some benchmark out of related to inflation or some measure of inflation out of the policy. I don't know. The way it would read now then would just basically be if we have money to do an increase, we'll do it actuarially, we can do an increase. But I'm not sure if that's really, is that what we really want to say, is that we're not going to have any concern for whether retirement benefits are going to keep up with the cost of living as a policy of the state? Because that's what we're—I think that's what we're, this change would do, and that doesn't—I'm not convinced that's at least at this point what we ought to do.
Because if the cost of living goes up, the retirees are
losing money.
Losing money.
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
On that point, if I'm reading correctly in the. On page 21, item 7 at the top, we in fact, as a legislature, did the very thing Representative Thiessen suggests. We made decisions based on the Consumer Price Index.
Mm-hmm. One other thing, if I could, Madam Chair, just a question. And
sure.
I understand there's also other mechanisms, other indices that we could look at instead of the Consumer Price Index. I don't know if there's anybody that...
Well, we have the pilot with the Consumer Price Index that we're going to get a report back on.
But is it, Madam Chair, is there an indice more targeted towards retirees as opposed to consumers in general?
Mr. Martin?
Members, to my understanding, know that there has not been an attempt to develop something as systematic and as usable as a Consumer Price Index for retirees. There are levels of poverty budgets that are put together by some federal agency, but they do those on a less than annual basis and don't necessarily measure the same things, so a percentage change isn't probably possible. And that's more, well, that would be, it's not specifically retirees that they're targeting on. While there are other ways that one could come at whether a benefit is adequate and stays adequate, nothing seems to approach the systematic and usefulness of the Consumer Price Index, even although the Consumer Price Index includes things that are not probably greatly utilized by retirees and probably understates proportionally some items like health care that are utilized by retirees.
Ms. Hocking.
Madam Chair, on that point about the CPI, there is an index that has been under development on an experimental basis that's geared exactly in the direction that you're speaking of, but most who have looked at it don't believe it is reliable, accurate enough to be used. In fact, AARP, which was originally behind trying to develop that special index, has acknowledged that it's got some difficulties and flaws. So it's we looked at this ourselves about a year ago with the idea of maybe recommending that to you, but as we looked at it in the research, it just didn't seem to be ready to be used.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Kapler.
Madam Chair, and Ms. Hacking's point, I understand to be correct. Nobody has any confidence in that segmenting of the population by age for cost of living, because you have all sorts of other interesting factors with regionalisms coming in to sort of corrupt the methodology. But and there's such the dispersion of impacts of cost of living depending upon a person's health standard and marital status and all of that make it very difficult. With respect to Representative Thiessen's concern, I think we would share it, and I would recommend maybe keeping paragraph D as it currently reads rather than striking that, and you might want to modify it where the word online 22 should is to say may, leaving it sort of more open-ended about what kind of escalator you want to link yourself to, and not necessarily CPI. You may come up with a better measure, find something you think is more equitable, or blends the concerns of active members and the costs of living that they're experiencing as well as the retirees. I mean, our goal may be to make sure that the benefit that the member, you know, has earned doesn't deteriorate in purchasing power. But that criterion all by itself doesn't take into account what's happening with the real wages of the people who are actually supporting the benefit payment stream ultimately. And so something that I would add, to the extent that you can get, and maybe you want explicit language to the effect, to the extent that we can divorce the notion of investment returns from our definition of benefit adequacy, I think that would be good, because I think the consensus is clear, at least at this point, that we've sort of gotten away from the notion of post-retirement benefit increases being conceived as a dividend in good times when investment returns are high. And the correlation is really quite opposite. When inflation's high, markets tend to be performing poorly, and when markets are performing well, inflation tends to be low most often historically. So anything that's based on investment performance, including the trigger that we now have in St. Paul under the pilot program, in my view doesn't make any sense. I think the two should be completely separated.
Madam Chair, let me withdraw my motion, since we have some additional language before us, and you know we had not had this before, so I'll withdraw my motion so we have the opportunity to discuss all the options here. So.
And where did the additional language come from?
Madam Chair, three of us, the three statewide systems, were talking before the hearing and acknowledge that there might be some difficulty with just saying we're going to ignore inflation or not have some tie to it. So this is language that we came up with just as a starting point for discussion, if you'd like to still keep a concept of inflation in the principle.
Thank you, and thank you for printing it out for us. And also, the next time, will you please put that down at the bottom, that where it came from?
Sure. Sorry about that.
And anyone else that wants to prepare language. Okay. Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rice. I'm here today representing Minneapolis Police Relief Association, Firefighters Relief Association. Just a couple quick points. The Commission's dealing with principles, and I would submit that the principle as drafted, 2C8, is really a very good one. And it isn't the principle that...
On which lines?
I'd say, I mean, in general...
The original
principle, when you're just looking at the principle, it says that retirement benefits should be adequate during the period of retirement. They should... post-retirement benefit adequacy should function to replace the impact of economic inflation over time in order to maintain a retirement benefit that was adequate at the time of retirement, that the system should be funded on an actuarial basis. And in order to replace inflation, the post-retirement adjustment should follow a valid, recognized economic indicator. Had the Commission adhered to that kind of throughout all the 90s and just done inflation rather than investment gains, I think I've seen some charts that were presented somewhere along the way would have shown that generally you wouldn't have these deficits. You know, you overpaid because there was these big payments. One of the reasons the inflation or investment return was there was you got back to the question of was the pension benefit adequate at retirement. And you're going to hear the Minneapolis or the teachers statewide saying we've got 33rd out of 35th or whatever in terms of the formula. I think as the Commission grapples with this, it's an important one to keep that in mind. I would think as a policy or as a principle, you'd like to say, yeah, we should keep people whole with inflation. That's a good policy. There are certainly some other ways to do it, but I would encourage, I think the language suggested by the retirement fund directors is better than the ones suggested by Mr. Martin. I think Martin is doing, you know, faithfully to the Commission. He's looked at what's happened in the past and saying, you know, let's conform our principles to what we did. But I think that, you know, as a practical matter, I think inflation is probably a better measure on how to do it. That's what Social Security does. The question becomes kind of what's adequate, what's fair, and that's where some of these problems arise. And I don't think, you know, the thought of as the on page 23, lines 14 to 23, where if it's kind of just going back to periodic increases, and I know that's been withdrawn, but just for illustrative purpose, I think the Commission in setting principles would want to at least set what the policy is out there. Now, whether you can follow it or not, that's always kind of where the rubber meets the road and whether you can do it, and there's a lot of reasons. But at least in a guiding principle document, I would submit that inflation probably is the single best measure for post-retirement increases. I think that's really where I in your seats, that's what I think makes the most sense. That's what Social Security does. Certainly you want to need to be able to fund it on an actuarial basis, build some assumptions into the plans to do it. It also then, though, again, brings you back to principle number 7, and that's the definition of what's an adequate benefit at retirement, and that brings you back to the discussion with the teachers. They're saying the formula isn't good enough. And I think that's kind of been the issue as somebody who's lobbied, represented people in this area for 25 years. That's kind of always the catch-up. You know, things aren't going as well for our members. What can we do to be creative? I testified last time. I mean, a lot of these principles in we have an escalator clause for Minneapolis Police and Fire, which generally mirrors inflation over a long period of time, not exactly. But even with our 13th checks or PRB, our average benefit in Minneapolis Police and Fire is still under slightly under what PRA Police and Fire pays to their members. Now, we've tried to find inventive ways to catch them up and to be fair and to work it, you know, make it affordable for the city, find a way to the state to do it. We've improvised and done other things. But in the end, all of those kinds of efforts have only kind of kept us up or even behind where the PRA Police and Fire average benefit is, or even, you know, pretty far behind, not, you know, well, significantly behind the Highway Patrol plan average benefit. So I would really encourage the commission to possibly work off what the three fund directors have come up with, but I think the policy really should be inflation. I think Representative Thiessen said it well. I mean, what's your principle? What is a fair, what's going to be fair to the retirees? And what would do it in such a way so that once they are retired, you don't have to worry about them. I talked before about my two great aunts who were MRF employees, retired in the 60s. You know, their top kind of, the glass ceiling was there for them. I mean, if they were alive now, they would have, instead of being the Secretary of the Civil Service Commission or the Secretary of the City Engineer, they would have run the Civil Service Commission and been the City Engineer.
Or be Vice President.
Or certainly. Certainly more qualified, in my opinion, than the current nominee, at least of one of the parties. Franny and Helen, though, they retired. Franny and Helen retired in the 60s, and then wham, inflation hit them, and there was no post-retirement mechanism for MRF. And literally, Franny wound up being on the welfare rolls for Hennepin County, lived to be 100, and Helen was a little better off, but relied on government assistance, too. You know, had they had an inflation-protected component, they probably would have been able to keep their homes and do everything else. Mm-hmm. But they didn't.
Okay. My name is Floyd Olson, and I'm here as a retiree. And I just have a couple of comments. I agree with Brian. But I've looked this over several times. And this is the proposals are radically different. These are radical changes. And the process, to me, is very confusing. I inquired as to what the status of principles were. And I found that, first of all, they say that they don't have any legal effect. Well, I don't know why you want to really spend all this time doing that if they don't have any legal effect. Maybe they do. Maybe that's for the future. I don't know. But by the same token, I was told that these principles were to give you direction. And what I have been witnessing is not that you are looking for direction by discussing criteria and then establishing principles. What's going on here is that you're looking at old legislation that was inconsistent with the principles you had adopted, and you are modifying the principles to be consistent with the inconsistent legislation. And I can't see how anyone can get direction from that. But aside from that, I don't think that if you go back and look at the legislative auditor's report, I really don't think that these proposals are consistent with what was recommended by the legislative auditor. The other thing I'd like to say is that, and I have a totally different perspective on this, I'm sure, than a political person. And that is because I'm a lawyer. I'm not a politician. But what I think you should be looking at for retirees is what is the obligation that you promise to undertake? Not is it affordable? Affordability is not the standard in the law. And in fact, if you look at the state of New York, if you look at Pennsylvania, if you look at New Jersey, if you look at Illinois, and I dare say if you look at the law in Minnesota, you'll see that at least publicly what has been stated is that the pension terms are fixed when you retire. I know some lawyers that you have will disagree with that, but I've listened to them, but I don't agree with them either. But affordability was not an issue when it came to the health benefits in the Chisholm case. And it was what obligation did you undertake? And in those states, by the way, Every one of those states have acknowledged that it's the obligation they undertook that they should look at. And what they are doing, at least as I read it, is they're looking at, because they have money problems too, what they're doing is looking at what their proprietary assets are that can be sold in order to get the money to cover those obligations. And that includes airports, toll roads, parking lots. But as I hear the discussion here in Minnesota, we're talking about what's affordable. I submit that the obligation of the legislature is to fund the pensions that were undertaken. Now, that may be a hard statement. And I understand politics. I've been around it all my life. I appreciate the problems you have. But the law, I think you ought to follow the law. And I think that inflation, when you said you were going to do this according to an inflationary factor, I think you ought to continue to do that. That's about all I have to say.
So, Mr. Olson, are you saying that a person that retires today mm-hmm. then should be getting the same amount of retirement if they get $2,000 a month today uh-huh. than when they retired at 65? Mm-hmm. Then when they're at 85, they should still be getting $2,000?
No, I'm not. What I'm saying is that you have determined what adequacy is. Adequacy today is $2,000, let's say. But if you apply an inflationary factor, heaven knows where that might be. My recommendation earlier was that you strike a balance. Your executive director refers in his report to empirical evidence when it comes to age of retirement. Let's talk about empirical evidence when it comes to what for the last 25 years has been an annualized inflationary rate. And I think if you use the figures that you're using, which are very close, I think, to what I got from the Federal Reserve, 3.22% is an annualized inflationary rate. Now, what you've done radically is changed this to 2.5%, and I can take quotations from your executive director and show you where he told you years ago when you did this that if inflation got out of hand, it wouldn't meet inflation. I mean, I have fundamental disagreements with the way pensions are operated in Minnesota. I was against, frankly, even though I've been a beneficiary of the pension being indexed to the stock market. But as I told you the last time I was here, I thought it was a wild idea. You know, people don't expect to get rich on this. But when you create a standard of living for folks and then change it so that standard is diminished, at the same time health costs are going up, everything is going up. I mean, I pay 10% of my income for health insurance. So I really would ask you, I would plead with you, to go back and take a look at this, you know, in a realistic way, in terms of what the obligation is, not in terms of what. I understand you don't want to tax people, but you know very well, as I do, that in a short time, you may very well be saying, "Hey, this is all now going to be shifted over to the local governments," and it's going to be shifted to the local governments because you're going to get below 80% of funding. And when that occurs, essentially what's happened is that the state obligation has shifted over to local governments, and you'll see it in the property tax. And to me, that makes no sense. This is a state obligation. So I have great difficulty with the way in which pensions are being funded in Minnesota. And I've studied other states. I mean, we're the only, we were, as I told you once before, I think we were the only state in the union that indexed, to have a standalone post fund, a standalone post fund in which the stock market determined what people were going to get. That's wild.
Ms. Bannick? Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, I think affordability is important. You know, we can promise the world to retirees, but if we can't afford it, we can't afford it. And I just, on the chart on page 22, and I remember my first home buying years, which unfortunately are getting back further and further every year. If you look in the, like, December over December inflation in that chart in the 70s, while certainly it is devastating for people in retirement, you cannot possibly, I don't believe, fund a pension plan to cover inflation during periods like that, of that magnitude. And so I do agree that we should try to provide some inflation protection, and in a perfect world, we would keep pace with inflation. But I just think to expect pension plans to keep pace, you know, if we run into a period like that again, it would be absolutely devastating to the pension plan. So, you know, I think I understand the idea of trying to trigger to inflation, and I think what we are trying to capture in what we handed out was as long as it's affordable. Because if it's not affordable, you know, I can promise the world to everybody, and ultimately we need the cash.
Madam Chair, my recommendation was to put a cap.
Mr. Olson?
My recommendation was to put a cap of 3.5% on the inflation factor, because it at least bore some resemblance to the 3.22 annualized average. And not only that, but that's what MRF is getting. MRF is being subsidized by the state. It's getting authorization to issue bonds. They receive 3.5% when every year. And I can tell you that inflation affects those of us who live in the suburbs just as badly.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Mr. Kepler.
I mean, without consulting with my board, I think the language that you have here from the three statewide plans kind of captures what we think makes sense. And I like the fact that the language is in there that says help offset, because it leaves a little bit undefined and doesn't hamstring you and doesn't make too formulaic or lockstep the way that a post-retirement increase would be structured. And I think that recognizes, you know what, CPI may not exactly capture the cost increase, the cost of living increases that are being experienced by retirees generally. And there's a general consensus among economists that CPI, as a measure of inflation, in most periods probably overstates what's happening with general price increases because it doesn't really capture substitution effects. The market basket of goods and services that's included when the Bureau of Labor Statistics collects all the data to measure inflation increases is fixed and immutable for significant periods of time. Well, if the price of a good increases relative to another relatively good substitute, you're going to switch that the substitute for the other good because it's going to get you the same relative marginal utility value in your purchase for a lower price. That effect, which economists knows goes on, is not captured in CPI, and there have been a lot of studies on this, and some have estimated that the overstatement of the CPI measures is as much as 1%. Some have said it's a quarter or 0.3%. Most of them tend to fall in that range between a third and 0.1%. So if you're funding CPI and you're funding it too lockstep, you may be covering more than the cost of living increase for retirees. But I think the general consensus is that retirees are are exposed to, except in periods where housing is inflating in price rapidly. Retirees generally experience a higher rate of inflation than the rest of the population because they're so dependent upon medical services and pharmaceuticals. And so you probably end up hitting the right point by tracking CPI for retirees, but I think it would be good. This language is good because it leaves a lot of flexibility about how the legislature is going to go about operationalizing that definition as you go forward. It doesn't tie your hands.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Olson raised a number of good questions for us. He did ask what's the purpose of the principles, and we of course operate under here and in the legislature, realizing that one legislature cannot bind another legislature. Decisions that one committee makes at one cycle may be of interest to a later committee or legislature, but we will pass public policy as we see it. But I think this particular area in pensions, probably has more interest in consistency than others. What happens with one adoption of policy is going to be cited later on. They're going to say, you did this for this one group, and now it's time for us to do it here. So I think we have to pay close attention to it. We are going to recognize that there are going to be increases. Nobody's ever going to say my pension is adequate. People are going to say I think it's time for you to go back because the inflation has changed, cost of living has changed, it's time to raise it. Perhaps the simplest thing for us to possibly do would be to simply amend the statutes to put it in there, and then we'd be done with it. But I think the pension plans are going to say, yeah, but have you paid for it then? Because if you have inflation, as we saw in 1979 and 1980, when it's running at 13% or 12%, if we haven't paid for it, putting in the statute doesn't do us any good. So I think that, trying to at least have some guidelines and so forth to help the pension commission, we're not bound by the principles at all. If we decide to deviate from them, as we have, we're going to do that. But we're going to recognize that there are going to be situations when the pensions are going to have to be increased, and the word adequacy may not be the appropriate word, but increases might be the better one. And we're going to have some ways to recognize that we're going to have to make adjustments, and not necessarily by putting in the statute. I think that the language that has been suggested to us by the funds might do a better job at it, that we recognize that there will be increases, but we do have to balance it out to say that we have to pay for them, as opposed to just writing it in statute that we're going to do it automatically. And so, as I say, I think the proposed language looks a little bit better than maybe what had been written in the memo. But I think that, as I say, Mr. Olson raised some good questions. But I don't know what's going to happen in the future for inflation. I don't know what's going to happen for cost of living increases. We want to give them to them, but we're certainly not, in my view, going to bind ourselves to say, well, if the stock market's doing well, we're going to award them, because that doesn't solve anything.
And it may create problems.
Yes.
In the future, like 10 years hence. And also, I think I appreciate what you said about the principles, and one legislature cannot bind another legislature, and that's constitutionally. And so also that we have to have some kind of guideline, which are the principles for us, and they have to be reviewed from then to now as new people come onto the commission and as we pass legislation which does not necessarily follow the principles because the legislature had another thought, which is their right, and which we do, as you said, which we do often. But we have to review to see if the principles are up to date. And that's why we're going through this on certainly not a waste of time. because the discussions have been very good, if not in offering different languages or accepting the language of the principles, but to talk about the meaning and giving us a background from where we can start the next time around. Yes. Mr. Rice.
Just last comment on B, the dependent clause, to the extent it is financially feasible. It seems to me that it's almost never financially feasible to do anything on pensions. So I guess if the focus is going to be on 2C8, if you just drop that clause out, because, I mean, clearly you can't get anything. Finance is always looming in the background. I mean, how are you going to pay for it? I mean, you have the greatest idea, the greatest formula. It's dead on arrival, or if it's a non-starter, if you can't find the money. Senator Betzold's told me that on more than a few occasions. I think it's certainly appropriate, and you really have to look at that. Can we afford it? But at least as a principle, I would hope the discussion goes out and say, yeah, we hope to be able to offset the effect of inflation. Now, can we? Maybe yes, maybe no. Mr. Bergstrom pointed out it. You, in the 79-80, throughout the 70s and the early 80s, nobody could have afforded to do that. That was part of the problem that led to the correction in the 90s. You know, Senator Betzold also said that, you know, we had a problem then. We tried to address it this way. It didn't work. We got to adjust and make some changes. But that would be the one thing, because I'm sitting here as you talk, Madam Chair. You know, it's 5 years from now, and the principle is that, you know, to the extent it's financially feasible. And, well, it's never feasible. So you had a nice idea, but go on your way.
And I guess I told Representative Thiessen that a couple times. This year, even. Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think to that point, I kind of think that language about the extent financially feasible doesn't mean very much. But we have other mm-hmm. principles that we're going to be coming to later that do get at that point. And, later on, maybe we've gotten to them already, but farther down.
We're going in order, but we're farther going down in chunks of three.
Yeah, so farther down, you know, they do talk about having it to put the burden equally on different generations and those types of things. So maybe we could just cross-reference that piece of it, too. But that affordability piece is already in our principles, I think, at some level. I also have some concern about this idea of periodic increases. I don't know what that means particularly either. I think we could write this in one sentence and capture everything we need to. So I don't know where we go from here. Are we going to adopt something today?
It depends if there's a motion. Otherwise, it's left hanging.
Okay.
And we have several that have been left hanging, several parts of the chunks. Mr. Fleming.
Madam Chair, if I might, Morgan Fleming here on behalf of Middle Management Association. And just it'd be a presumption to think of coming up with words to suggest how this advisory document, that this advisory commission, advisory to the legislature, what you will do. But, you know, there's the state gross product is $240 billion, 5.2 million people, more than that now in Minnesota. Representative Smith asked how many were retired or whatever. I think the count on Medicare recipients is 780 or 820,000 people. You know, in the state, you would well know that in, I remind what Senator Betzold was saying about uncertain things in the future. Moses doesn't know what happens next. Things are so volatile now. I used to, younger in my life, I was in the bond business, and if it changed 0.2%, it was a wild thing. I mean, that's, no one even pays attention to that now. So it's uncertain what's going to happen next. You folks, the state probably annual budget is $20 billion and $6 billion of federal money you grant or whatever. The nice news is that in the post fund, there's $25 billion, a little bit more. $25 billion is kind of an active fund that Mr. Bicker runs generally. And the 2.5% of the $26 billion is $655 million a year is what the COLA gets. I don't know if that's adequate or not. It's a lot of money. There's a lot of resources. It's going to change. We've done a good job with forced savings that make the defined benefit thing a fact. Those 150,000 annuitants in Minnesota to get a check every month, defined benefit, are throughout the state, on all 87 counties. And the wonderful thing that this legislature has done, all the people that have sat in your chairs and you folks, is that that's the infrastructure to keep those little clinics and hospitals and service agencies alive throughout the state. So my little guess, I've never had the responsibility you folks have, but the broader sentence you write is mindful of things being uncertain, and the superior ambition to address adequacy, maintain adequacy, well, that is a great, great thing, whatever that means, better. In fact, if you could write it in pencil, it'd be kind of neat, because it's for sure it's going to change. So I just comments. Thank you.
Thank you for that reminder. Any further discussion? Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, I'll just add a short idea. On the handout that the directors developed, I would say in B, the second sentence starts off with help offset. And to get at the comments of Mr. Olson, some of the concerns of Mr. Olson and the comments of Mr. Bergstrom, focusing on long-term impacts of inflation and not year-by-year wild gyrations that we have, double-digit inflation. There's been years when we've had deflation. So to get at the focus on the long-term effects of inflation, in between, on that line, help offset the impact of long-term economic inflation. I would just, a suggestion, just to insert long-term in between of and economic, because there could be short-term economic impacts over time, long-term impacts over time, but I think we're all focused. And I agree with Mr. Bergstrom's comments. We really can't match inflation every year. So the focus should be on the economic impacts of long-term economic inflation. Just a suggestion.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Okay. Principle 2C10.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe I'll at least throw it out here. On the unless staff has any suggestions on the revisions suggested by the directors, I'll make a motion to adopt their language, strike and B to the extent financially feasible, because, as Mr. Rice indicated, that's always going to be there anyway. If it can't be done, it can't be done. But I think that Mr. Stoffel's point on the long-term inflation probably should be considered, because I don't think we need to be addressing changes or increases, you know, every single time that there is an adjustment in inflation. And we are more interested in the long-term inflation rather than just, you know, every variance. So I would move to adopt the fund director's proposal, but strike on B to the extent it is financially feasible, not because I dismiss it, but because it's just always going to be considered, and that to add the word long-term after the word impact of. So I'd move that change to the principle.
Sam Petzold moves the deletion of to the extent it is financially feasible and insert after the word of long term. Any discussion? Mr. Kapler?
Madam Chair, I hate to extend this discussion too long because I know you've got other business to attend. And I understand the intention behind the insertion of the term long term. My concern with that is what's the long term? If you're 3 years away from your expected date of departure from this temporal world,
and headed for your eternal reward. I mean, the long term is 2, 3 years, 4 years. I don't think the last 2, 3, or 4 years of a person's retired existence should be eating inflation and be deteriorating in its standard of living by virtue of the fact that we've implemented some smoothing mechanism. I think you take care of kind of the long-term issue by capping off the increases that you'll permit even under CPI. I mean, if the feds get absolutely reckless with monetary policy or international governments who are holding U.S. bonds decide they're not going to finance our foreign trade deficit by loaning us money and start dumping U.S. bonds on the market, we could experience hyperinflation that would make what Brazil went through in the 1960s look tame. We can't chase that, and we can't possibly cover it, and local governments shouldn't be obliged to basically pay up an ante for missteps at the federal policy level. So I think the cap accomplishes what you want to do, and long-term inflation is okay, but it could result in you know, members experiencing 2 or 3% relative reduction in their real purchasing power, their benefit, potentially in the very last years of their retired life, and I think that might be confounding. We like the idea of third quarter over third quarter CPI. It's not lockstep with it month by month. It's the way Social Security does it. All of our members going forward are covered by Social Security. Why should the COLA be radically different?
Madam Chair, I'll withdraw my motion. I thought that the fund directors may have talked about this amongst themselves. Apparently, they have some divisions within their own ranks, so I'll withdraw my motion.
Did you write that sentence yet?
I have something written. Do you want to hear it?
Yes.
Okay. It's actually two sentences, but it would just say, and this gets at this issue, subject to periodic increases, I think, is kind of a, it could either mean we're going to increase it every year, or it could mean the legislature should come back and give increases kind of on an ad hoc basis. So it gets rid of that. But basically it would say retirement benefits should be increased during the period of retirement to offset the impact of economic inflation over time. In order to maintain a retirement benefit that was adequate at the time of retirement, the system of periodic post-retirement increases should be funded on an actuarial basis. So it just kind of captures that this principle, and it has to be put in the context of all of our principles, is that what we want to do is offset the impact of inflation.
Madam Chair, Representative, maybe we could pass on the overall principle today, and you could have that drafted up so we could.
That's fine with me. Yes.
Submit it. Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
And we can meditate on it.
Yeah.
Okay. Principle 2C10.
Members, on the memo, this is the bottom portion of page 23 and thereafter, has to do with the purchases of prior service credit. In the main, before probably the mid-70s or later 70s, the Commission faced very few requests for purchases of prior service credit. Perhaps the introduction of the retirement age 62 with 30 years of service that occurred in 1973 or some other revision in the benefit plans made service credit more important to individuals at a time where we also have generally been reducing the vesting requirement. But something triggered in the 70s the desire on the part of individuals to purchase credit for a service that was previously credited by the pension plan. And the 95 revision of the principles attempted to put into a single paragraph or a single sentence the policy that was developed by the commission from 78 through the early 90s. And that's stated on page 23 in the middle of the page. It has a large number of components, and the thrust of the legislation that's set forth, that the 24 variants that are set forth in the next couple of pages,
are largely not paying much or any attention to most of the variables or various requirements that are in the current set of principles. What seems to have been operative for the commission over the past decade or thereabouts is that service credit to be purchased has to be real time. It has to be some time that was served somewhere doing something. Some retirement plans around the country refer or permit the purchase of air time, hypothetical time, time that was never rendered doing anything in particular. So we do appear to require that it be some period that's a discernible period of employment or something comparable to employment, and that there must be the payment of a full actuarial value for the purchase, and that full actuarial value should not be should not ultimately be a subsidy from the pension fund. And if it's an individualized case, that the purchase not violate notions of equity. Beyond that, we have not followed to any great extent, it seems, in recent years, the principle as stated. So this one, I think, is ripe for modification in the sense that if this document is to assist other legislators when they attempt to understand why the commission does what the commission does, or if they're trying to anticipate what the reaction of the commission will be to proposals, this the current statement of the policy principle doesn't do a very good job to alert your colleagues or the people that they represent or attempt to assist in any great extent. So I've suggested on page 27 a revision of the principle, which attempts to narrow down and focus in mostly on the full actuarial value process. It also attempts to pick up something that's increasingly part of your considerations, which is who bears what portion of the cost. The commission in the last several years, if the employer has had is responsible, can be demonstrated to be responsible or accepts responsibility for having caused the loss of service credit, that the lion's share of the full actuarial value payment is assessed to that employer rather than a portion of it borne by the member. And the later clause, I would attempt to capture in language that growing trend in your deliberations. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions, and there undoubtedly will be our reaction to the change.
So, Mr. Martin, does this proposed change in language on page 27, then does that say that the Pension Commission would have to move if they were going to consider a bill? Move for consideration of an issue to be brought before them? Or if a member has a bill, are you saying that the commission would, as a whole, would have to determine whether they were going to hear that bill?
Madam Chair, the things that the commission would be determining, the way you do when you choose to vote on any bill, are the five bullet points. Were the requirements set forth in the five bullet points met?
So
I don't think
we would still be referring to it in a case-by-case basis? We would,
Representative,
or not.
Sometimes we have done service credit purchases on a case-by-case basis. We also have, especially in 1999 and 2000, when we permitted all parochial school teaching service to be purchased, foreign teaching service,
military,
various other broad-based service credit purchases. We have done a number of service credit purchases other than on a case-by-case basis, where we've generically decided that we're going to permit the purchase of, by anyone on any in any event, certain kinds of military service, certain kinds of family leave service, certain kinds of parochial school, foreign school, whatever. So we're suggesting, since the commission is, has not adhered, has found a good reason not to adhere to doing things only on a case-by-case basis, to have everyone who ever was in a parochial school have to submit a separate special piece of legislation. Doesn't seem to be a particularly practical approach. So where it's appropriate to not do it on a case-by-case basis, you've not done it that way. And by putting in our policy that we only do it on a case-by-case basis, gives people the individual, or gives folks the sense that any purchase can be done on a generic basis, or can be done. We will deal with these as they come, either generic or individual, as the circumstance demands.
Thank you for that clarification, Senator Betzel.
No, I was going to point out that you know, we sometimes have had individual cases, those, you know, unique situations, but we have had broader situations too. But virtually in every one of them that I can recall, and as is pointed out in the memo, we always ask, what's the cost of the fund? You know, does the fund think that they can absorb this? If there's a error that was caused by the fund, then we try to allocate the liability out that way. But I think that the language that has been proposed here seems to be the path that we've usually gone down, and I'm interested to see where, if the funds agree or disagree with, you know, the language that we have proposed here.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, I think we're comfortable with most of the language. One of the items we had a concern about on the second bullet at the end there is or an omission. I think omissions are in the eye of the beholder sometimes, and every time someone calls and they didn't send in something on time, you know, they say, you didn't tell me. And even though you can show them five times, they said, well, you should have told me one more time. So I would recommend the striking of or an omission. You know, I think clearly if we made an error, but those words make me a little nervous.
Any other comments? Mr. Stoffel?
Madam Chair, I also have no major problems with the language. It looks like a good set of language. In the second bullet point, as a way to further cleanse some of the language from some of the negative connotations, and we've been talking about that in the other principles, but in the second bullet point, at the end of the fourth line, appropriately calculated, seems to imply that... well, I don't know what it applies, but I don't think it's necessary language. Obviously, we're going to try to make all of our calculations appropriately. It seems to have a lot of negativity, that as if maybe we were doing some inappropriate calculations before. I, again, I'm not sure why it's there, but I don't think it's needed.
For principle.
Representative Thiessen.
Can I just ask a more general question on this one? So and it kind of relates to the first bullet point. I mean, if this is what we're doing, where basically you have to purchase the full actuarial value so the funds aren't hurt, why wouldn't we just let anybody buy into our funds as an investment vehicle?
Mr. Bergstrom?
I think if, from my standpoint, you know, buying sort of airtime could be an issue. For example, if I knew I was up for a promotion and we calculated the actuarial buyback, now I get the promotion and the cost may be higher. And to me, we're not necessarily an investment house. We are a pension plan. And I think I personally have some concerns about just letting people buy any time. That's my philosophical belief. You know, it's we're there to cover the people during the time they were employed, and allowing purchases other than that, they might be able to qualify for the rule of 90. Law changes may change where they get additional costs later on. Markets may plummet just after they do it, and now the liability extends. So those would be my concerns.
Mr. Kapler?
Madam Chairman, I would be the same. I think Representative Thiessen's question is an honest one, and I think we sort of drift back and forth between the strict notion of service credit for service rendered and this notion of running something analogous to an open mutual fund where people just purchase annuity contracts. An insurance company is doing that based on their risk assessments and expected longevities of the people that they're extending coverage to, and we're doing it for a different group of people. It's an employment-based benefit. We're not really just running an investment vehicle or an insurance company to cover the potential adverse event of a person living longer than you expect. And inherent in the plan itself are risks. We think we know what the proper parameters are in costing these programs after we do an experience study and faithfully implement the results, but we don't know that with perfect certainty. In fact, it's pretty imperfect certainty. We know because the models that we use to cost these plans out are rather static, not very dynamic, not very stochastic, kind of fixed and rigid in the parameters that we establish for projecting costs. So inherent in the very design of these things and the way that we project costs for them, we're taking significant risks in financing these things. And it's why I think it's one thing for governments to take those risks on behalf of their own employees, but to assume those risks for a broader population, it just seems harder to justify. So I think there's a whole industry out there that's capable of providing that service to people, and we are wholly unqualified to do it.
And Madam Chair, if I can just, I mean, that wasn't entirely a serious question, although it, I think, does raise where you start to draw these lines. But the other thing that was a comment that somebody made as they were going over this is that one of the benefits of these kind of defined benefits plans is that it is forced savings. And I think that part of it is that in the private sector, that's we're having a very serious problem with that as we look down the road. And I don't know if it's through this commission or elsewhere, we really need to start, you know, this is about retirement and pensions, I guess, but we ought to start really thinking seriously as public policymakers about the private sector side of how we're doing with retirement and what we ought to do differently to encourage or maybe or nudge people to be saving more. And so that kind of was part of the mm-hmm. piece of it too there.
And just an added thing is even in when we established that one group of employees could change from one policy to another, we didn't just transfer them at the cost. We made them pay back what they would have for the years that they had been in. And so they had to pay additional money to get from one plan into another plan. So we don't want the people that have been in the plan and having to pay for new people coming in.
Madam Chair, I'm frankly comfortable with the language as it's written in the memo. Although Mr. Stoffel raised a question about appropriately calculated, that has been part of the principle, and I think that that is actually something that has guided us because we assume that, you know, it is going to be appropriately calculated. As to Mr. Bergstrom's comment that concerns about, you know, unless an error or an admission by the pension plan was responsible for the credit, there have been situations where there has been errors or omissions. Now, just because some claimant comes in and says, I didn't know about it, even though there's been perhaps evidence that they've been told about it many times, I think that the person who's, you know, seeking to have a purchase credit or buyback, it's up to them to prove to our satisfaction that there has been a problem. Usually, you know, if there's been a problem, the plan admits it. They've said, yeah, we messed up here, you know, we didn't have the information, or we didn't have it there. But just the claimant saying so doesn't prove it. And I think that the you know, it would still have to be evidence that there has been an error, that has been an omission. And unless somebody proves it to the satisfaction of the pension commission, I think that, you know, we wouldn't go along with it. So I think the language as it's written here, I think, can cover the situations as we've been presented with them, that there has to be an actuarial determination that the fund is going to be kept whole, that it is going to be appropriately calculated, unless there is an omission or error that we're going to assume that the costs are allocated appropriately. So I'm okay with the way it's written here. So unless somebody can bring up anything further. So I'll move actually the language, page 27, lines 1 to 21.
Any additional discussion? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Principal 2C13, reopening optional annuity elections.
Members, this policy principle is relatively short. It can be found in the middle of page 27. It indicates a blanket statement that reopening the election of an optional annuity should not be permitted. There was one instance where there was a specification that the election of a particular annuity form in TRA was not irrevocable, was eliminated. We probably raise this one because there are numerous instances where individuals do seek, particularly in the case of marriage dissolutions, where an ex-spouse is the optional annuity designated party, where there's interest in changing optional annuity elections. And so this is this is not driven probably as much by the variant island legislation, but to give you folks an opportunity to again think about in a dispassionate way whether you want to allow optional annuity elections to be reopened or not. Generally, individuals have a single life annuity. It's payable for their lifetime only. Or at least that's historically how we've framed our pension benefits. And that has a certain actuarial value. We permit individuals to take their benefit, to take that value in a different manner, sometimes by using a term certain annuity where the benefit is payable for a certain period of time, even if they were to die prior to that point in time. In other instances, by use of a joint and survivor benefit, is the other typical optional annuity, where a second life is permitted or is accorded the right to receive a portion of the annuity after the prime recipient dies. And sometimes those are 50% joint survivor, sometimes 75%, sometimes 100%, where the benefit to the second life is equal to the benefit payable to the first life, and there's an adjustment so that the benefit payable from the first payment is smaller than the single life annuity amount in order to accommodate that actuarially. So that's how optional annuities work. A
fair number of our retirees take optional annuity forms. If they're, we have covered back several years ago by if the second life predeceases, if they die prior to the prime recipient dying, that bounce back feature is part of our optional annuity programs, and it is subsidized by the pension funds. It is part of the actual cost of the pension plans ongoing. But this is, again, the reopening issue. The new language, that's on page 28, picks up the practice by the various pension funds that there is a window that has been established in some cases where the initial paperwork will be ignored and subsequent paperwork will be followed in optional annuity forms, and the pension fund folks can tell us what the what their practices are, but that would be the addition that would be suggested on the middle of page 28.
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair and members, I wasn't going to comment, but when Mr. Martin referenced the marriage dissolution case, I think we think the principle as rewritten is fine. I just wanted to raise that we will be bringing a bill forward that will address the marriage dissolution situation, not to open up for an additional selection of an optional annuitant, but just allow it to bounce back so the parties could change their mind about sharing the pension, so the member could bounce back to the higher amount, and the now ex-spouse would get marital assets through another resource. So I was going to suggest to add something, but I think the principle as it's being stated is fine, but I just wanted to give you a heads up that I'm going to already bring something that departs a little bit.
Any other comments? And that's going to be in the next session.
Madam Chair, I'll move lines 1 through 4 on page 28.
Okay. Any further discussion on the Betzold motion? Representative Eason?
I don't know if it really, the new language really adds anything, to be honest.
Yeah.
So I think the old language
doesn't
probably captures the concept anyway. And it may just complicate things. I don't think you have the bullets in the house. I don't think it really. Well, anyway.
Members, if I don't want to get into
Mr. Martin.
This, but the specific rules of the commission are to recommend legislation. You need a majority of each body to do other matters. Only requires a simple majority of the quorum.
We might lose out.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I'll take this opportunity to extend some goodwill to my colleagues in the other body. And it seems to me that it doesn't really, the language doesn't really change the intent either way.
I'll withdraw the motion.
But we all agree that it's a good principle.
It's a very good principle. Yeah.
We all agree with the intent of the principle.
Yes.
All right. If not, that concludes our discussion of our chunk for today, and we will go to the next chunk of three in the next meeting, whenever that may be. You will be polled, and if you have any great suggestions on how we should proceed or what we should be requiring in the study, which we should be done with in a month and a half time or so, please bring that forth.
Madam Chair, do you anticipate a meeting in October?
I do, okay. But My calendar, and I imagine my colleagues' calendars are filling up on a daily basis, so that I'm not sure if it can be at a 4 o'clock in the morning to sure. 7 or something. It may be. But we really should. I'm going to try to do that. Okay. But we'll see what we come up with.
I'll say tentative goodbye to Senator Larson, but he may or may not be with us.
Yes.
We don't know. But,
that's right.
But his out date is November 5. So
yes. Well, we think we're going. I'm working on trying to get another meeting because he might be here, rather than have a blank spot.
Okay.
So
there you go.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for coming back, Senator.
Yes. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Do you want to have that subcommittee at some time?
Yes.
I've been looking at. I've identified a number.